The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On July 26, 2007, the Korea Society hosted a lecture by Dr. Laurel Kendall, an anthropologist at the American Museum of Natural History. Held in conjunction with the opening of a new exhibition of Korean funerary figures at the Korea Society Gallery, Kendall's lecture detailed the structure and importance of the ancient shamanic rituals that Koreans traditionally perform for the dead.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have with us this evening a leading anthropologist and a renowned specialist in Korean cultural studies from the American Museum of Natural History. Dr. Laurel Kendall's expertise ranges from the traditional to the modern and everything in between, based on everything I have seen and heard. She's done work on Korean shamanism and the role of women in Korean ritual life, and she's authored a number of books on these subjects and many more. And she has very kindly agreed to share with us tonight her insights on these figures and the rituals that they are associated with. And we are really honored to have with us such a distinguished expert. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Laurel Kendall.
Thank you, Vince, for that very nice introduction. And special thanks to this wonderful mix of effort on the part of the Korea Society and the Ongnam Foundation to bring these wonderful gokdu to New York. As a fan of folk art, I have enjoyed these figures where I've seen them, usually in Insadong, but I never expected to meet them in New York City, and I think it's really great that they're among us. As several of the remarks allude to, these figures that seem so whimsical, so happy, so sometimes humorous, are bound up in something very serious, the transition from life to death, something that is a basic human universal, but with a particular Korean take on it that allows for whimsy, that allows for humor. And that's what I will be talking about tonight, that transition, that journey, the journey that all of these figures, as you know from the labels, were decorations on funeral biers. And the journey of the funeral bier marked a transition. It marked it performatively, it marked it symbolically, from the village, from the world of the living, to the grave. But also it marked the transition from being a living member of society to a new identity as an ancestor. And as in many, many, many other places, that transition was marked with very elaborate ritual. Now, before I talk specifically about Korea, and is specifically about the transition marked by that journey of the funeral bier decorated with all of those wonderful figures, I want to try for some context, North American context. I think everyone in this room has, when asked to comment on the topic of death, would say grief is a process. One does grief work, one looks for closure. That's the language we use today. There's some general cultural understanding, I think even among people who haven't taken an anthropology class, that funerals, memorializations, commemorations, such as they are, however effective or ineffective they are supposed to assist us in this process of grief work and the seeking after closure. Attitudes toward death in Western culture, in Euro-American culture, have changed a great deal in 100 years. Jeffrey Gore, who was an anthropologist and a belles lettres, he noted that around the time of World War I, whereas in the Victorian world, death was a big part of culture. Queen Victoria wore black for, I don't know, umpty years. If you read Dickens or Louisa May Alcott or whatever, death is a central literary event, and mourning and grief were very visible. Around the time of World War II, Gore felt he had lost his brother in the Great War, and he found it very difficult to talk about what he was feeling, and he registered a cultural shift, probably attributed to two things. On the one hand, with medical advances, deaths of children, deaths of young people were less common, less a part of something that culture had to digest, as a matter of fact, as a day-to-day. But on the other hand, an event like war that takes young men in those days, we're doing it to young men and women in our day, and causes them to die before their time, then becomes so shocking, so aberrant, so uncomfortable that death and the grief one feels about such a circumstance gets muted, gets hidden, gets tucked away, becomes embarrassing. Now, in the United States, late 20th century, I think we've also seen a shift. I think we've seen a shift from dissatisfaction with the ways that death is commemorated in mainstream American culture, the way it would have been commemorated in the 1950s and 1960s. And this is also attributed to some other changes in American life. A kind of polarization in religious experience, where on the one hand, many people who may have gone to church on Sunday as children have become very secular or very New Age, seeking from a broad array of possible answers to the grand questions of human existence. And then on the other, the rise in evangelical charismatic Christianity. And both of these trends, I think, we can see as a kind of a rejection of a dissatisfaction with the kinds of rituals, the kinds of answers that the religion they knew as children, the mainstream American Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism was offering them. Another change, of course, and this is where Korean Americans come in, also is influx of different cultural answers and experiences that are part of the American scene. Now, two developments, if you think about death commemoration in America today, that seem to be reactions against trying to do things differently, trying to make them more meaningful, saying that the ceremonies that existed are just empty words and they don't really help you through this transition, through this journey, the way the funeral bier helped people bridge the journey of the dead in Korea. And one of these is something called the life celebration, which may be done with, you know, with a funeral also, or maybe separate, but an attempt to, well, an essentially secular statement of that's sometimes more in a more celebratory mood, remembering a specific person rather than marking their passing through a fixed liturgy that has very little to say about them. The other, and this one really fascinates me, is the Wayside Memorial in New York. If you remember after 9/11, there were all of these shrines set up with letters to the dead of 9/11 and teddy bears and stuff put on them. And I remember at the time I was hosting some Vietnamese researchers at the museum, and they went out and they photographed all of this, and they said, oh, it's just like Vietnam. You also honor wandering ghosts. And I said, well, you know, actually, our culture's really bad at honoring wandering ghosts. We don't, you know, we don't know what to do, and we borrowed it from the Mexicans, taught us how to do it, because we needed something. And these kinds of commemorations had been around before, not about 10 years previous to 9/11, I think. You began to see them at things like sites of traffic accidents, sites of other disasters. And I think that also, to me, represents both the seeking for a meaningful way to mark death, especially inexplicable deaths, and also the wonderful ability of humans everywhere to borrow from each other and to be receptive to other ways of doing, knowing, understanding. The emotional need to address the invisible presence of the dead, to somehow address the dead directly, to acknowledge them as a social presence. And this is something that the rituals I will be talking about in Korea, I think, do remarkably well. When anthropologists look at funeral customs around the world, we often find that in many places the dead are regarded as social entities, as people with whom, as ancestors or as troublesome wandering ghosts, one has some sort of social relationship. And also, many, many places, Korea certainly, mourning as a process is seen as unfolding over time, and that long unfolding is punctuated by different ritual markers. For example, in Jewish tradition, as many of you know, on the first anniversary of the death and the unveiling of the tombstone, in the Korean tradition, traditionally, a punctuation of the end of the first year of mourning with a special rite of commemoration, and then the end of the second year, which counts as 3 years in Korea, but a recognition that it really is a process that takes time. In Korea, as I've mentioned, the dead continue a social identity as ancestors. Those of you who are familiar with chaesa, I know many of you in the room are, will look at this and say, that's not a proper chaesa tray, and in our family we do it differently, and in our family we do it better. In fact, this is a setup for a shaman ceremony. Everybody says, oh, shamans, yeah, they don't do it right. But what I want you to note is how there's a mix of formal elements that you would find, you know, the candlesticks, the fruit, although in a proper ancestral tray you would have the red ones on one side in the east and the white ones in the west, but some attempt to approximate it, and yet at the same time an acknowledgement of a person who had tastes and desires. There's the alcohol down below, but there are some of you know that the Bacchus tonic and the 1BD that are very popular in Korea, and obviously the deceased was also fond of them. And you see the wrapped box of cigarettes also on the right there. You might, if you see from the shape, you can tell that under the wrapping it's cigarettes. Can't hurt them now. And So there is this sense of existence, but it's a transformed existence. And the journey to the grave, the journey of the funeral bier, enacts that. It's sort of, in some sense, as the labels about the figures communicated, a parallel journey. There's the literal performance of the bier carrying the corpse from the village, And there's the sociological work of the living mourning and acknowledging the separation. And then at another level, there's the mythic transformation of the dead going to the land of the dead, having to pass through the underworld. And the underworld in Korea is a bureaucracy. Hell is a bureaucracy, you know, and you get judged, and if you were okay, you make it into a better incarnation. People who write about beliefs in souls in East Asia from a literal Western perspective say, and they have three souls and they're in different places, the bones stay in the ground, and the soul goes off to the underworld to get judged, and the deceased in the tablet or in the photograph comes back home and is an ancestor, and nobody cares. Well, you know, why should we care? It can all happen. It's okay. You know, it all works. The bones in the earth are conductors of geomancy. You're familiar with Pung Su in Korean, Feng Shui, the energies that flow through the earth, and then they connect with the bones in the grave and they get transmitted back to the living descendants. Now, in a traditional village, the bones are on the hill behind the village, and it's easy to get some sense of veins in the earth. As people live apart from where their ancestors are buried, you begin to hear metaphors like the veins are actually sort of functioning like electricity, this invisible charge that's floating around. The ancestor who comes back, now there's an interesting transition. Traditionally, of course, it would be a tablet, a wooden tablet if this were an elite family, a paper tablet for humbler people. For a very, very long time, it's been a photograph carried in the funeral procession out to the grave and then brought back. And in a traditional Korean home, which most Koreans don't live in anymore, but we're certainly living in them in the village where I did my field work in the 1970s, an altar table would be set up on the veranda with the photograph on it, with the incense, with the candles, and the dead would receive offerings when the family ate their meals. So that although the ancestor isn't back deep inside the house, this is sort of liminal space, it's inside the house gate, but not in the house, all the way inside the house itself. They're, you know, working on transition, but they're still socially in the family such that they're fed every day. Then there are these two rituals of at the end of the first year, so that's 2 years, and the second year, that's 3 years of mourning. At the end of that third, that's the great leave-taking, and the picture is burned, and mourning clothes are burned. In old Korea, among super yangban, a very filial son would have been living in a hut by the grave for all that period. And that's, but this is the end. They come back to the real world. And, but the dead aren't gone. They're not as present, but they're still social actors. They still participate. There's still an emotional bond and a social bond and a ritual bond. And let's see. Okay. And as most of you know, they come back as, you know, sort of like visitors. They make occasional visits. On those occasions, when the family gathers together, they come back on the anniversary of their own death, and those rituals are held, well, they used to be held at midnight. People fudge now and they do it earlier because they, you know, they have cars and they drive home. It isn't like everybody in the same village anymore. And they come back on holidays, on the Lunar New Year, on the Mid-Autumn Festival, and the festival begins at dawn with a commemoration of the dead that is in the form of a meal. Oops, sorry. And in that celebration, if you think about it, the dead are served, and then in the somewhat traditional village house I lived in, the men, the living men, eat, the elders, and then younger men, then women and children. So in there's a social hierarchy, but there's also commensality. There is eating together as if it were another, like a wedding banquet or a big celebration. The dead are a part of that life, and they're part of that life for a couple of generations, as long as there's social memory. And when social memory dissipates, domestic ancestor worship ends. But if people are yangman, very noble, then the dead become ancestors of the lineage and subject to these very formal lineage rights, but that's a different kind of identity. That's more of an abstract identity, and I won't talk about that tonight. Okay, now, ancestors. If one assumes that the ancestor is in some sense present, and I know there's a lot of debate about this in Korea, people who say, oh no, it's just done out of filial feeling, and other people who say very literally, yes, the ancestors are there, yes, the ancestors like Bacchus D, and so they're going to drink it, at least absorb the essence of it. Shamans, of course, they feel the hunger of the ancestors, they feel the sorrow of the ancestors, they feel the pain of the ancestors inside their own bodies. And when they perform kut and certain other rituals, there are points in those rituals where the ancestors appear. And when the ancestors, and ancestor in the broadest possible sense, including proper ancestors who have descendants to honor them, but also the wandering dead youths who died before their time. In this instance, she's a young woman who died before she could get married, and she's very frustrated, and she's very flighty, and she causes lots of trouble to a family who has such a spirit, and it's the business of the shamans to and the clients to pay her off when she shows up in ritual so she'll calm down and leave them alone for a while. Other occasions, sometimes the recognition that although there is a bond and although there is this tie, there are special places and times for it to happen, notably ancestor worship. If the dead are too much with the living, that's not healthy because they don't belong there. There's a saying in Korean, 죽은 손은 가시 손이다, the hand of the dead is a hand of thorns. And for example, in one case that came to a shaman baby who got sick, not seriously, but got sick sort of mysteriously, and the shaman said, grandmother wants to see the baby. So she came and she had no ill intent. She stroked the baby and that caused the baby to sicken because she shouldn't be there. So you have to do a ritual, and you know, grandma hasn't been properly sent off, so we will send grandma off and everything will be okay. In addition to the rituals of the funeral and the mortuary rituals that go on for 2 years after, there are shaman rituals where the dead do become this very vivid presence, where you, it's quite a psychodrama. I've participated. In fact, I think I took this picture when she was manifesting my own father, where you have some meetings, some recompense, and where living and dead are allowed to say all of the things that they feel bad about that they could never say directly in life. These rituals called Chinogi Kut, the ancestors show up in every kut. They're just a part of the scenery. They're there with the household gods, and you talk to them and you deal with them. But if it's felt that the dead are really still too much here, and it would be good for them to get them through the underworld and make sure that they've gone to paradise, to Kungnak. If you remember in that in the exhibit, there's an image of a Buddhist monk and he's wearing a red banner down his body. It's a charming little figure. And it says, in effect, go along the way to Kungnak, to paradise. And the rituals for the particular kut that shamans do for the dead, the Chinogi kut, it's intended officially to get the dead out of the underworld and on the way to paradise. And it's also, as I describe it, you can see how it's dynamic, is intended to also emphasize for the living that this is a process of separation that is constructed in terms that are both good for the dead and good for the living. It can be done very soon after the death, if people feel that the person, you know, died before their time, died with urgent business, died in such a way that they really need help, or it can be done years after if the dead keep showing up in a shaman's divination. Those of you who've never heard me talk about Korean shamans or anybody else talk about Korean shamans, I want to say a few words about this style. I realize many sophisticated modern Koreans have never seen a kut or seen kut on television. This is a style of shamanic practice where the gods and the ancestors are called into the here and now and performed into being by the shaman. Shamans claim that they feel sensations in their own body, they hear, they have visions, they see things, they enact as a one-on-one, but what they're experiencing is more of an act of translation, taking some random out there and in here and putting it together in a coherent way. So that, for example, she would say she felt the compulsion to cry welling up inside her when my ancestor was with her, and this was something that had to be let out. So she was, in fact, doing it in the ancestor's behalf to free the ancestor of those feelings. The kut for the dead takes place if people are going to do the special ritual. They've done a full kut already in a traditional Korean house, as I saw them in the 1970s in the countryside, it would begin outside the house gate. The gods would be called in, and then the major kut would be performed inside the house itself. And many of the gods are located with specific locations inside the house. Most of it would take place on the open veranda, the mana, the maru. And then it would move out again, outside the gate. And with that moving out usually involves rituals of purification and exorcism, casting all the unclean things away, so that for the client family, their path is open, they're lightened, everything becomes possible. And the kut for the dead then takes place in this wide open madang outside the front door of a traditional house. Now, what about modern houses, you say? Well, I'll show you some examples. The kut begins. This is the saja, the death messenger, and I think some of these attendants that you see in the carvings, especially those who look like policemen, colonial-era policemen, are intended to be in the persona of the saja. The saja is modeled on the yamen runners, who used to come and, you know, if you broke the law, these guys would come and they'd grab you and take you off to prison, and your family would have to pay bribes so they didn't beat you too hard and so that you didn't starve in prison and maybe got a better cell and that kind of thing. If you know the tale of Chunhyang, the Bansuri, it's one of the most famous works of Korean literature. There's some very, very funny asides going on when poor Chunhyang is unjustly hauled off to prison because she won't become the concubine of the majesty, evil. Musty magistrate, but there's a lot of banter back and forth about the bribeability of the yamen runners. All right, but you don't want them showing up at your door. And in fact, the saja shows up at the door. This is death coming in to haul somebody away. And the way shamans, in most of a kut, the transformations all happen in front of your eyes. There's a bunch of costumes, and they put them on, and then they dance, they jump, they are in the persona of the god. When it's done, they tear the costume off, they're jumping to change their state back to normal, they fling the costume into the client's arms. This is different. The shaman goes off around the side of the house in costumes, and then shows up at the door. Usually with a very spooky expression on her face. And what women are supposed to do is they're gathering around the door to keep the Sajjah from going in and taking anybody else. You've got to defend the house. These women were a little late, and the shaman banged on the door, and they realized, whoops, uh-oh, and they skittered over. Now, in Korea, 20, 30 years after the fact, people certainly don't live like this, most people. Very few houses like that. How did I get that? And, uh-oh. Now, so you will see modern apartments and, well, modern houses. You can't do equipment in an apartment. You have to go to another rented space. But spaces interior where people then have to hover around a narrow door inside, and what used to take place outside and was symbolically appropriate to the outside really actually takes place indoors, but in that first living room-like space. All right, so the death messenger can't go inside, and the death messenger here is trying to steal food that's been prepared for the ancestors, complaining, you know, you're not giving me good stuff. If you see that little tray down below with the rice bowls on it, in Korea, when someone dies, if the family is very traditional, they'll put out a tray of rice for the three sajjah, for the death messengers who come to haul the dead away, and they will put out three pairs of straw shoes, which are shoes to wear on the journey. And that association with the event of death is being recollected in this appearance of the sajjah, who is trying to steal stuff that's intended for the ancestors. And the women are saying, oh, we have good stuff for you, you know, you don't need that. And then the sajjah sits down, and the sajjah is voracious. And being a, you know, kind of low-down, crude guy, the shaman stuffs her mouth. She would hold a little bowl underneath and just fill the mouth with everything she could stuff in. And then holding the bowl, the shaman would actually try to spit as much of it out as she could because she really didn't want to swallow it. But it gets quite messy, as you can see here, and that's part of the drama, part of the terror of the whole thing. And I think a little bit of terror and chaos and over-the-topness and danger is what's being evoked here. And then the sajjah gets bribed. She's holding, you can barely see it, she's holding a dried fish. And the fish is used as a prop in the cook for the dead. It often is supposed to be like a stand-in for the dead person. And she threatens to beat it with her bells, and then the women give the money. But they banter. These are tough country women. They know what they're doing with kut. Some present-day women are, you know, depend on the shamans to help them out. But these women, 30 years ago, really knew what they were doing, and they weren't handing that money over easily. And then it gets rolled and put in the fish's mouth, so the fish has a safe journey. This is a little bit like you know, the notion that of putting coins on the eyes of the dead to pay off the dog as you go to the underworld, this old Greek motif. All right, and the sajjah's paid off, he's gone. Yay. Then, a lovely work of Korean folk literature, the tale of Pari Gongju, the tale of Princess Pari. A shaman sits at the drum, and she holds it in this, usually it's like this, but she's holding it like this, and it's a story of a sunless king and queen, and they produce seven daughters, and with each birth, they're so disappointed, they really want a son, and then finally, the seventh child, the king says, enough of this, we're going to throw her away. And that's the name Pari Purida. And the queen, of course, is remorseful, doesn't want this to happen, so she arranges for the baby to have things to milk to drink and, you know, sets it off to float. And the child is saved by Buddha, there are lots of, this Kut for the Dead is of course saturated with Buddhist imagery because the idea of Buddhist salvation is very present in funeral imagery and activity. Anyway, Buddha saves her, gives her to an old man and an old woman who are sort of immortals-like living on the mountain, and she grows up and she learns magic arts from them. But Buddha's really angry at her parents for throwing her away, as you might imagine, and he makes them ill, sick to the point of death. And realizing they're going to die, they really want to see and apologize to the daughter they threw away. And so a messenger goes out and finds Princess Pari. Oh, yes, they're told. They're told, first of all, the only thing that will save them is a magical herb that grows in the underworld. And it's a dangerous journey to go and get it. And they ask their daughters, their six daughters, to, you know, can you go, can you go? And they have all of the excuses that affirm to anybody listening to this story why daughters aren't as good as sons. I can't go, my father-in-law's having his wind up. I can't go because, you know, we're having a chesa day in my in-law's house. All of these obligations that have taken them away from their parents. All right, so they find Princess Pari and say, you know, we just want to apologize to you. And she says, I was 10 months, things last a little longer in Korea, I was 10 months in my mother's womb and I was the product of my father's seed, so I will go to the underworld. Even though you threw me away, I will go to the underworld. And then it becomes this story, this adventure story, the kind of story male heroes in many myths, in many parts of the world undertake, but this is Princess Pari. She's a girl, and she does this. And she goes into the underworld, and then she gets distracted. There's this guy who says, oh, I know where the magic herb is, but I won't tell you unless you marry me and have seven sons. Which she finally does. She does. And time is kind of fungible in these stories. And she, one day she's drawing water from the well and she sees the herb reflected in the water. She says, oh dear, gotta get back. She grabs the herb and she goes tearing off and her husband says, what about me? What about the boys? And she says, well, you can come if you want to. And they follow her. And remember, this is being enacted in a ritual performed mostly by women for an audience mostly women, and it's really cutting through all of the tensions, all of the difficulties that daughter feels, because she goes to another family and her bonds with her parents, the love is real, the sense of obligation is real, and then there are social obligations that pull her in another direction. And this tale is saying, but daughters can help do the work of saving their parents. So Pai Kongju goes back, but lo and behold, what she's greeted with is her parents' funeral procession. But the herb is so, but while she's journeying through the underworld, she has seen the souls of the dead going over, and they're in so much grief and so much chaos. All right, she goes back, she sees her parents, she saves her parents come back to life, they say, we'll give you the kingdom. And she says, I don't want it, because I've seen the suffering of the dead in the underworld, and I want to go back and help them. In effect, it's a bodhisattva story, the moment of this great attainment. And she says, out of my compassion, I will help suffering people in this afterworld, in this difficult transition. And so she becomes a goddess, maybe the first shaman goddess, some people say. And she, that journey is memorialized in the song, but the song is also a map. Because the map, the shamans say that the dead learn the way, learn their own navigation through the underworld as the song is told. The way shamanic songs in many, many cultures recount journeys that the shaman is simultaneously experiencing and telling. This is what it looked like in a modern city house 20 years after the first picture, and you can see that whole association with outdoor space is gone. You can also see how much more prosperous the shamans are, how much more elaborate the costume, how much more they're able to replicate the splendor of a princess image. And then the song being sung, the shaman dances around the offering table, and this represents the journey through. Well, first, before this happens, a fee is collected to pay the bribes to the gatekeepers in the underworld. And in this instance, this was a recent death, and the widow and the children are following the shaman. It's a funeral procession that becomes a guiding of the dead through the underworld. And this motif of guiding and going with and helping out that you see so nicely illustrated in the wooden figures. And now notice the widow has in her hands a bundle of cloth, some very fine cotton and some very coarse hemp. And that's the next part of the ritual. These are called bridges. And the bridges are stretched out, and some clothing for the dead is placed on the bridge, and also they're putting money on the bridge to help ease the transition. And this is the journey. The shaman will cut through the cloth. She's carrying scissors, she's chanting Namo Amitabha Buddha's chant, and then she dives at the cloth and rips her way through. First, the coarse bridge, this is the way out of hell, and then the fine cotton, the way into heaven. Now, she doesn't just go smoothly. She'll stop halfway and say, oh, I want to see Oogie. I can't leave before I see Oogie. And she'll come back and I'll say, Oogie's gone home. Or, not here. Oh, but I won't, And then goes back and then stops and comes back. I don't want to go. I really don't want to go. And people will say, here's some travel money, here's some money for cigarettes, and she'll go on again. This is very similar to what used to happen in village funerals when the beer carriers would carry the beer and they'd stop. And the living had to pay them off, and in that process, ease the transition, be in the position of saying, as people say to the dead incarnated in the shaman, go away, you're going to a good place. To put themselves in the frame of mind where the distancing that's healthy for them is healthy for the dead. And to see it so graphically illustrated by the tearing, the ripping, the opening up of these roads. And whoops. I have one last picture and I'm trying to find it. Yes. So now what does this give us? It gives us this sense of directionality, of moving out, moving through social space, through ritual space, and through the mythic space of the afterlife. And it's a very, very potent image. As some of you know, the Chinonki Kut became a protest idiom in the 1980s. Shamans who performed with dissident students and workers and pro-democracy movement, and also some students who acted like shamans, who then went and started hanging out with shamans to learn how to do this, one or two who became shamans themselves in the process. But the idea there was that it's the martyrs to democracy who have so much pent-up frustration. You have probably all heard the expression han, that deep feeling of resentment for historical wrongs. And they were young when they were killed in the flower of their youth. They were killed fighting for a struggle that was yet unrealized. And these massive demonstrations in Seoul in 1987 included these very graphic rituals and made use of that tearing of the cloth. It's a tradition that continues. I tried to find the slides for it, but I couldn't find them this afternoon. But there is a group of very young shamans, idealistic, rather hip, and they were asked by a feminist group, let's do something for women. Let's do a shaman ritual for women to celebrate women's culture. Well, what should we do? And the idea they had was, all right, let's do a kut. You know, you have to have a real purpose, the shaman said. So they said, we'll do a kut for the sake to comfort women. They died young. They died historically aggrieved. This is something to put them over, to help them, to send them on. And the shamans said, okay, we'll do it. And they did. I think this was on the campus of Iwa, or maybe it was on the campus of Yonsei. It was a Christian university. But they had a lot of trouble because they said, because there's no one present who really knew these women, because this is just being enacted as a political symbol, we can't call them up. We can't get them out. All we hear is their crying, this inarticulate weeping. And you know, they felt that they needed to do something about it, but they didn't know what, and they were troubled. They went on, and a few years later, they had figured out what they needed to do. And this group has dedicated themselves that they will do a kut for the dead, for the comfort women, in each of the 8 traditional Korean provinces. In other words, this means that to fulfill their mission, they're going to have to also perform in North Korea. And when they perform, they have comfort women from that area, surviving comfort women, be present, be there to help. And I saw this once, and it was really very touching. A couple of hominis were there, and when the shamans incarnated the dead comfort women who were weeping, and then the grandmothers came up, and there was kind of mutual comforting going on, and it was really tremendously moving. So that something that is a folk idiom becomes a very powerful political idiom in the contemporary among people who might have 20 years ago considered themselves very far removed from all of this. Okay, I'll stop there, and maybe we have some time for a few questions.
Floor is open, please.
Oh, yes.
We're going to have a couple of mics circulating, so hold on just a second here.
Were you able to communicate with your dead father so that... Yes, they wondered how they would be able... The first time they called up any of my relatives, I said, you know, but they didn't speak Korean, and the shaman says, yeah, we wondered about that ourselves, but no, their Korean was better than mine.
And they were, I mean, your father?
Yes. Well, the picture I showed you on that occasion, it was pretty... formulaic, I knew what to expect. But I did have one very strange experience with this. Would you like to hear it?
Yes.
Okay. It was within a year and a half of my father's death, and I did a smaller ritual, but it was for the sake of my father. And my father died of cancer, and I remembered one of the last times I saw him, he touched my back and said, I can feel your ribs. And I thought, you know, don't worry about me. You know, you're the one we're worried about. And in this ritual, when he appeared, the shaman came over and rubbed my back and said, I can feel your ribs. And I thought, this didn't really happen. I just imagined it. But Diana Lee, my colleague, was videotaping it. And it really happened. I have documentary evidence. This really happened. I... Don't tell my colleagues at the American Museum of Natural History. I lost my job.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you very much for your presentation. I know that all of our various human cultures on planet Earth are very unique, etc., but as you were speaking, I heard a lot of similarities between African cultures and rituals, and I remember many years ago I went to Zimbabwe, for example, and there was a special ceremony one year after the death of the person on the day of their death, and everyone had to stay up all night for the celebration, etc. And so I know a lot of people get very upset when you compare their culture and their unique experiences with others, but could you touch upon that?
Okay, yes, that is an interesting question, and thank you for putting it that way. And that was part of the reason why I tried to set up with North America and general anthropological insights. All Homo sapiens sapiens have language, but we speak different languages and different idioms and different argots. And I guess that, to me, is the fascination with this field. If it were all totally different, there would be no anthropology. If it were all totally different, you know, we wouldn't be the same species. The fact that we all have to contend with the idea of death, and we have dreams, and we have memories, and we have things that are fairly unique to our species that makes the finality of death seem incomprehensible, and the need to bridge it. And, you know, our species has been around long enough to know that some things work, like consider making grieving a process. Sometimes we forget that, but, you know, a lot of people in a lot of places seem to have caught on to that. I wouldn't call it a universal. I get nervous with universals, but I think that's something that many, many people in many, many places find emotionally satisfying. And the pity, like in Korea, I mentioned this 2 years of mourning, and now it's, for most people, it's all over in 49 days. It's compressed. And people are reading the literature on grief work because this is a need now. This is a new thing. So, yeah, we learn, we forget, we experience. But thank you for sharing that.
When did they stop using the figures and the beers and everything, or do they still use those, the things that are like what we've seen in the other two galleries?
Okay, I think that Mrs. Kim could give you a better answer. I know that they were still sold in the 1970s, newly made ones. I bought some, but they weren't as beautiful. They weren't anywhere near the beauty of what you see in the gallery.
Right now, she said that they're not used pretty much, and they traditionally supposed to be burned up after the the ones that are left, most probably ones that are more important than others.
Thank you. Perhaps I should direct the question here. I'm an artist, a mixed media artist, so with reference to the little doll figures, I know they're carved out of wood, and they're made, most of them, at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. But what I'm curious about, because of how they look, is the nature of the painting, the medium which is used. I'd like to know if you know what the pigment is, and also what the medium is in which the pigment is, the vehicle that the pigment is hanging in, whether it's water or oil or tempera.
Thank you.
They're the tradition. They're not regular kind of paints, but more traditional paints called Bangcheon that were used to the same kind of paint that was used to paint on the roofs and the eaves of the temples and the Buddhist temple and such. So it's that kind of pigment.
What's
the
mineral? But what's the vehicle it's hanging in? Is it water? Is it egg? Is it oil? The pigment is mixed into what to get it to stick?
Is it a family business to make the dolls, or do shaman make the dolls? Who makes them?
So it's not a shaman or Lord Bodhi family, but rather it's someone within that town's people, or town. Townsfolk that had the talent for crafting these things and doing that. So it was basically local arts that were making these.
This is a question from Dr. Kendall. Can you explain how the dead body is treated during the funeral? In other words, are they cremated? Are they buried in the ground? And I know that in Korea they build a mule, right? It's a,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
a mound. So can you explain a little bit of who does what?
Who does what? Okay, it's very complicated. Traditionally, Buddhist monks were cremated. And that's one more sense that the monk does not belong in social life. No ancestors to transmit things through the bones. And other people were buried in the ground on a mountain. People refer to dying as going to the mountain, that spatial configuration is important, and mountain land is burial land, was often a very important part of a family patrimony. However, things have changed with urbanization, and the government has tried to encourage cremation to save land. And there's a lot of tension, a lot of emotional tension in families over cremation and how they feel about it, whether they feel that, they aren't going to have a proper afterlife if they're cremated. I remember one family, one of the shaman's clients, I think it was, who was really very upset because her daughter, her middle-aged daughter, had died and had been cremated by her in-law's family, and the woman considered this such a violation. But it's, I think statistically today, you would probably find more cremations than burials in the ground.
I have a question. Since we talked to dolls, you made some theatrical production. I was wondering, with this funeral celebration, whatnot, if you had ever associated with music in Korean tradition, Samul was involved in this funeral procession or not. My son happened to be a musician.
Uh-huh.
He explores a lot of crossover music. I was wondering if there is any music that sort of traditional music was followed into this.
Korea is a very musical country, and music accompanies everything important, basically. There are regional traditions, of course, and the music of different funerals is different, but there are Buddhist chants. There's a song called the Haeshimgok, which is a song about the regrets of the soul as it goes through hell and borne away, and it's It's such a grief-inducing song that the words make the living cry, which is also considered a very good thing, to cry. The shaman ritual, of course, is full of music. The ballad, the Parikongju, that's a long ballad song, and it's a real performing art. It's very hard for shamans to master. They say they have to have inspiration. The gods have to allow them to do it, but they also have to work very hard to memorize it. And it's usually the Kut for the Dead often take place in the early spring when the wind is really cold, and in the 70s, they would sit out in the open courtyard and they would, in the cold wind, hitting the drum in this wind that could make their fingers go numb. And they would perform, if it's performed properly, it goes on for a couple of hours. If they were really cold, they'd speed it up and they'd do maybe an hour. And then, of course, there are all kinds of chants and drum rhythms associated with the shamanic traditions of different regions as well.
We have time for one last question, if there's one more out there. Please.
I was curious if you had witnessed anything with a male shaman.
Male shamans. Yes, they exist in Korea. And there are two. When we say shaman, we're translating a Korean word, mudang. And there are mudang in the north and center who are chosen by the spirits in proper shamanic fashion, and they have experiences of sometimes craziness or mysterious illnesses, horrible misfortunes, and then finally they accept their calling. In the south, there are hereditary shamans. They would be born into it. And you might call them a priest instead of a shaman, but everybody calls it. In Korea, they're mudang too, so we use the word. In the north, where they're charismatic, where they're chosen by the spirits, there are men, but far, far fewer men than women. And when they perform, if their body governing god, their guardian spirit, is female, and the female spirits tend to be attracted to the male shamans, they put on female clothing before they wear the robes that you saw the shamans wear. They put on traditional Korean dress, traditional Korean women's pantaloons, traditional women's slip. And so in effect, they become women in order to become gods. Friends get
contradicted. No, as a person who spends some time in the Chola area, I have to take exception with the actual proper shamanic tradition.
Well,
anybody from the Tongo tradition would acknowledge that as appropriate language.
No, I meant proper by the criterion of a global literature. I realize that an older generation of Korean folklorists considered the southern ones the real mudang.
On that note, thank you. Thank you very much. Who knew that this subject would generate A, this crowd, and B, the sorts of questions that we've had here tonight and the fascination with this subject, number one. Number two, as somebody who's lived in Korea and worked on Korea for the better part of the last 36 or 37 years, I can only say in reference to the last question that any time that anybody tells you that Korea is a male-dominated society, hold on to your wallet. Number three, I was actually looking forward to the afterlife until I heard Dr. Kendall describe it as an elaborate bureaucracy. As somebody who's just retired from the U.S. government after 35 years as a bureaucrat, I don't want to go through that again. I've been to hell and it wasn't fun. I want to thank our wonderful presenter, Dr. Kim for what you've done this evening and making this possible. This is a fascinating evening. I think it's a tribute to both of you, the fact that you've had so much fun here tonight. And thank all of you for coming. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.